The Diary of a CTO podcast. Sharing the secrets of successful CTOs. Brought to you by Trunor, the home of technology recruitment. Hosted by Guy Bevington.
Nick, welcome.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Thanks for having me on.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday. Happy St. Patrick's Day.
It was a bit weird. It's not Guinness, isn't it, actually? But I don't know if they... Did BrewDog do Guinness? I don't know.
I'm not too sure. But lived in Scotland a while, so yeah, big fan of them.
That's a tasty drop, actually. You've got a Lost Lager. I've got a Planet Pale. Both nice. Cool, good. So, Nick, welcome. Thank you very much for being
Thanks
here. Really excited for this episode today. So I guess by way of introduction, Nick, you're an entrepreneur.
Yep.
You are the founder and CTO of a company called Connect Earth. And that, I'm sure, we'll go into that in a lot more detail and you'd be far better to explain it than I. But it seems like a really exciting tech startup, which is building an AI platform to help companies track their carbon footprint more accurately and obviously help with all the reporting around carbon accountability and sustainability and that kind of thing. So I think we can all agree that's a really kind of worthwhile mission that you guys are embarking upon, and a really interesting domain as well. So I'd be really interested to pick your brains on sort of your approach to that in terms of the platform you're building. But before we go into that, I always like to start with just hearing a little bit more about you, your background and how you got into technology in the first place. So if you'd be so kind, give us an overview of your background, how you got into tech, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, of course. Thanks a lot for having me, Guy. I'm Nick. I'm the CTO and co-founder of Connect Earth. We're an environmental data company based out of London. What our mission is a company is to break down the barriers towards accessing some of the leading environmental data and tools. So we work with some of the leading university research groups to package some of these really high quality carbon emissions data models and data itself, and make it accessible through code and through APIs. We like to think of it, and there's a big movement in the climate space, which traditionally was done all on Excel files, and towards the software and API-ification of this whole climate space. And I think we'll touch upon this probably later on, but really, really interesting time to be in the climate space as well, and
Absolutely.
Emerging of many different sectors. So
yeah.
Me a bit more about myself. So my background's mainly in climate tech and AI and software engineering. So studied AI and software engineering in Scotland, so where okay. BrewDog is also based. Okay. I actually saw one of the founders present in the Social Enterprise World Forum, which was really nice to see. But very early days, was really, really passionate about how I could use my technology skills in the intersection with social impact and environment. So from university, became very, very passionate about how I could use tools for good, going to hackathons and making environmental data and tools more accessible, Chrome extensions that could estimate the emissions of what you bought on Amazon. Mm. From that, created my first company, which was in the open banking and climate tech space. So when open banking was just recently legalized in the UK, and what we did was we allowed users to connect their bank accounts to an app and used the UK's EEIO environmental data in order to allow them to understand the emissions of what they purchased. So that was kind of my first experience really into the climate and carbon modeling space as a CTO. Later went to work at Amazon as a software engineer on their Softlines and Climate Pledge Friendly features. It was the fashion part of the Amazon website and apps. And it was a first introduction of a functionality that allowed users to see sustainability credentials of products and have an understanding of the sustainability of their purchasing decisions. So it was a really interesting glimpse. Learned a ton at Amazon as well. And then fundamentally, a year and a half, 2 years ago, started Connect Earth with my co-founder, Alex. The story is quite funny, and I have to thank my partner, my girlfriend, which I owe everything to. She got into Entrepreneur First, which is one of the leading kind of global startup incubators. And I just thought that was so cool. And it's something that I was just really, really wanting as well. And I asked her, can you please refer me? So we pretended through the whole program that we didn't know each other pretty much. but I owe everything to her. And it's where I met my brilliant co-founder. I've never met someone I think as dedicated as Alex. And we started the business Connect Earth. Very early on, we had a mission of how can we do our part in climate change? What's the biggest thing we can work on right now? And through that journey, which I can touch a bit more on, we talked to some of the heads of sustainability at some of the largest companies in the world. We also saw that fundamentally consumers and businesses had no idea what their environmental impact was and how to reduce their emissions. You go doing these daily actions, have no idea how that's impacting the planet. And also that even though you can't necessarily point the finger at individuals, households influence up to 60% of global emissions. So they have the power to influence purchasing decisions to go to greener companies, greener suppliers, and in that way shift global emissions to reduce. So maybe not pointing the finger, but saying, hey, you as an individual have the power to choose to purchase more sustainably. And if you just empower them with the right data and tools, you can help reduce global emissions and improve kind of climate awareness.
Fantastic. Wow, that's really, really interesting story. I love the you know how you guys got together and you know coming through the sneaky route through your other half. That's lovely. But no, I think it's a great story and a really worthwhile mission, like you say. And I think the it goes without saying, you know, carbon modeling is obviously an incredibly complex problem. You know, that involves analyzing lots of different data sources, and it appears to be a very rich and you know, interesting problem that you can approach from a data science perspective. Yet from a lot of the conversations I have in the market, yeah, it's still a relatively niche space. You know, there's not that many people working in it, even though it's a problem that, you know, is affecting everybody, you know, in the planet. It's still an area that a lot of people don't necessarily know a huge amount about or haven't really done a huge amount in it. But when we speak to people about it, you know, that the movement towards tech for good, yeah, we're certainly seeing, I think since the pandemic, a lot of the better candidates out there in the market are genuinely really interested on a daily basis about the types of problems they're solving. You know, it's not just about going in and doing the job anymore. They really want to know that, you know, what they're applying themselves to on a daily basis is actually, you know, really having a social impact and making it a big difference. So I think there's a real space for companies like yours at the moment, and especially with the advancement of, you know, data tools and you know, processes and where we are now, you know, I guess it's kind of more achievable than ever before. But talk us through then a little bit about, I suppose, what really inspired you to start Connect Earth as a business. I know you said you like the idea of social impact, but you know, what sort of made you kind of put all your eggs in one basket and build that business, and what sort of specific challenges are you trying to address within the sustainability space?
Yeah, totally. And great question. And even on, I think the recruitment side, which you touched on earlier, I think it's one of the, if you're a talented and passionate technical person in the data or engineering space, you just see tons of people right now, really talented people flocking towards climate. And we've just been able to recruit such a rock star team, not only, I guess, by our processes and what we do as a company, but fundamentally by the mission and knowing that people are working on problems that are bigger than themselves.
Yeah.
And I think that's what kind of gets us out of bed every morning. Personally, I've been involved in the climate space for a while through, as I mentioned, Amazon, through my previous business and throughout university and my studies. But fundamentally, there was two, which I touched upon before, two main insights that drove us to do what we're doing now. The first one is we started off our journey knowing, me and Alex, that we wanted to do our part in helping solve climate change, which we thought was one of the biggest challenges of our time. So what we did was we talked to tons and tons of people. I remember early days messaging 500 people on LinkedIn. That was our task, me and Alex, in our first few months of starting and speaking
working
to
recruitment.
As much. I don't think I'd be very good at it. But talking to as much people as possible, and we got the opportunity to talk to some of the heads of sustainability at some of the biggest companies in the world. And what they were indicating to us was there's this notion in carbon accounting called scope 1, scope 2, and scope 3, which is when you're looking at the carbon emissions of your own company, scope 1 and 2 are the emissions. Scope 1 is the ones emissions you directly release into the air. If you drive a car, if you burn something. Scope 2 is the emissions that you have from electricity use. Scope 3 is the emissions you have from pretty much interacting with any other company as a result of, for example, supply chain, logistics, delivery. It depends on how it works. But the main insight that we found was talking to these really, really big companies and consumers, most emissions, 60 to 80% of carbon emissions come from scope 3, meaning your interactions with other companies and suppliers, unless you are pretty much electricity, basically provider, generator. You're into really energy intensive things. Mm. So the thing is, it then makes it really hard to do your carbon accounting as a big business, as a small business, as a consumer, when you're so dependent on other people and other people's data in order to understand your own emissions. And one of the fundamental things that we understood when we were like, okay, we want to help consumers and businesses better understand their emissions, because the first step towards reducing is understanding and measuring. And that's where a huge part of the data part comes. But it's really hard to do so if you have to rely on other people's. And this is where carbon models and the data science aspect is so important, yeah. Right? Yeah. But the learning from there is your financial platforms are actually one of the best places to understand your carbon emissions. Because if 60 to 80% of your emissions are coming from your suppliers, and this scope 3.1, which is purchase goods and services, where can you find the best place to find your purchase goods and services is the financial platforms, your banking platforms, your accounting platforms, what you invest in. And so that's what started our route towards how can we make tools that help businesses and consumers better understand the emissions of what they buy? Because okay. Fundamentally, it leads to most of their emissions. And the second learning we had in my previous business, I remember being in Edinburgh next to some of also the BrewDog pubs and some of the biggest kind of climate protests that there were in the UK, and being surrounded by, I think it was 20,000 people really, really caring about climate change and wanting change, but fundamentally not understanding how their daily actions really affect climate change and having no data. Yeah. If we had carbon labels on everything that we bought, it'd be very easy. But obviously scaling that is very hard. And so again, your purchase goods and services, your bank account is one of the best ways to understand where your emissions hotspots are. Okay. And your carbon magnitude is in that way, better understanding and reducing your total emissions. So those two key learnings drove us to our product now, which is the API-ification of these carbon models and data. What we have is Connect Earth. We have open documentation. We've always been very developer first. We're builders at heart. And we've made it really easy that through one line of code, you can estimate the carbon emissions data of transactions, of investments, of companies, access carbon offsets. We really are just looking to become that infrastructure, allowing anyone that wants to build climate-related products to do so very easily without having to hire a team of carbon modeling PhDs. And abstract you from the necessary knowledge many times to be able to build really impactful climate products. And in that way, also have that available to consumers. If you make it easier for builders, they can then show consumers their carbon footprint through, for example, their bank accounts, their financial platforms. So in around a year and a half, we've been able to show carbon footprint estimates to more than a quarter of a million users in their bank accounts. Wow. And we're currently engaging in some really interesting POCs and with clients to further scale that impact. But I think fundamentally helping increase the base level of carbon knowledge and ability to reduce for consumers and small businesses is kind of two of our really big goals as a company.
Fantastic. Yeah, it makes a huge amount of sense. And I totally agree with you. I think it's one of these topics now that we're all definitely aware of, and I think generally speaking there is a lot of goodwill there and people wanting to do the right thing, but I do think you're right, a lot of it boils down to, you know, I guess the level of ignorance to a degree that people don't really understand, you know, what they're doing. You know, they haven't got the access to the data to really understand you know, how their actions on a daily basis, be that consumers and businesses, what impact that actually does have, you know, in terms of the carbon. I mean, I was just thinking actually when you were talking there, and I was thinking about us as a business of, you know, scope 1, scope 2, scope 3, you know, unless like say you're a huge business that's got a massive amount of servers, I guess scope 2 is relatively minimal with a lot of businesses, and actually scope 3, you know, we as a business, you know, we do have, I think, quite positive incentives where, you know, for every placement that we make, we'll plant 10 trees and we'll have, you know, a sort of focus towards adopting in that way. But a lot of the work that we do is physical events as well, you know, and we've got offices based up in the north, and I'll very often catch a train up to the north without necessarily thinking about actually the kind of carbon footprint that's going to have and on that. And I think if there was a platform out there that kind of gave that information, that data more readily to businesses, then, yeah, you know, that's kind of the way you affect change, isn't it, ultimately? So, yeah, I think it's a great idea to be that kind of enabler for businesses, like you say. So how do you kind of see, you know, sustainability and carbon accounting evolving in the coming years? Because I guess it's one of those areas where advances in technology and data science, data analytics have kind of made it more accessible and I suppose more accurate now than it ever has been before. How are you kind of, what sort of exciting trends are you seeing within that, and how do you think Connect Earth is positioned to, you know, adapt to those changes?
Totally. I'll just mention two, I think, very different aspects that I think are fundamentally revolutionizing a lot of the climate tech space. One of them is more of a tech one, I think maybe more relevant to some of your listeners, of what has been some of the fundamental changes that have led to advances in carbon models. And another one is what's pushing the sector towards going, as especially in Europe, to go as fast as possible, and why this is becoming a huge priority. There's a perfect storm of incentives and climate regulation that is just making the need for climate-related products very, very high, especially in Europe. So the first one, maybe a more on a technical side, is I think you've seen, I like to think a lot of programming languages just as general languages, right? And so it's a lot easier to interact with people if they're speaking the same language. I think Python has helped enable in the data science space so much improvements and innovation. Primarily because now engineers that are working on the front end, on the back end, can communicate in the same language that data scientists and the machine learning folks.
I totally agree.
So it's been a universal language that has united different domains in the tech sector.
Yeah.
And what's really interesting is this is actually happening in carbon modeling as well. So carbon modeling courses, specifically, for example, in EEIO, our carbon modeling scientist we got from a university reference. Yentl is a really, really talented EEIO and carbon modeling person whose courses and a lot of now carbon modeling courses are being taught in Python. So having a similar language where carbon modeling people can speak to data scientists, can speak to back-end engineers, can speak to front-end, I think is causing just such a speed up in the amount of communication and innovation that can happen at a given time.
Yeah.
And so I think it's the creator of Python for the unification of a lot of different domains and just making it easier to have multidisciplinary action on one thing.
Yeah.
The second thing is climate tech regulation. So you have right now it's really kind of clever how it's done, but already, asset managers in Europe have to report on the emissions of their investments. And what's interesting is it's actually somewhat sometimes unexpected, because as an asset manager, an investor above a certain kind of revenue and amount of assets, they're expected to report on sustainability features of their investments and carbon emissions. Many times the investments that they've done don't actually have carbon emissions reports. And so you'd wonder, okay, why are they being asked and incentivized to do this? And I think what Europe and their regulators have fundamentally understood is a lot of power is held by investors. And if you start the regulation from the top, it'll trickle down in pressure. So right now there is a direct regulation and then also just market pressure for companies to report on their emissions, because then their investors can report on their emissions.
Okay.
So
yeah.
SFDR and TCFD are some of the regulations that have really pushed this on a really interesting perspective. And the same is with banks. When a bank gives, and that's where our Connect Report product comes, we have a white labeled solution that banks can integrate to allow their business customers to create compliant carbon emissions reports. This is really helpful towards the business. And I'll explain some of the regulation in Europe around kind of businesses, but also for the bank. Because now the bank has to understand, what are the emissions that I have from giving a loan towards one of my business customers or investing or providing services to them? Because I have to report that as my financed emissions, which are 100 times bigger than my operational emissions, offices, et cetera. And fundamentally, it's climate risk to myself as a bank financial provider if I don't understand the emissions or empower my customers to understand their emissions. So it's a really interesting kind of perfect storm starting in the investment and asset management financial space.
Yeah.
That's why we're primarily focused on it.
Okay.
And then a second wave of regulation coming through CSRD, which is coming in a few years in Europe. It'll mandate any company above 250 employees to report on their emissions. This has never happened, and above a certain amount of revenue. I'm originally from Spain, and if you ask a business what are carbon emissions, you're likely not to get much answers. So there's a really fundamental need for a lot of these tools that simplify the understanding and the ability to report on your carbon emissions. And because of this whole scope three thing that I mentioned, even if you're a company below 250 employees when it hits, if 60 to 80% of the emissions of the companies that do report are from their suppliers, they're going to be asking all the companies that they work with for their carbon emissions and reports. There's market pressure downstream as well.
Yeah.
How this the regulatory kind of status in Europe is fascinating. It's creating a lot of downwards pressure basically for everyone to have better carbon emissions data. And it's fueling a new wave of climate techs to be able to supply the tools so that companies, businesses, asset managers can actually report on these emissions and understand them, because right now it's actually really difficult to do so.
That's really interesting. I didn't know that about the specific incoming regulations. So that's kind of European-based companies as of next year, is it? That's coming into effect.
Yeah, and there's some specifics. So some of it is still obviously being tweaked and adjusted. And one interesting thing that's also kind of planned after that, the triple effect is a carbon border tax. So having taxes based on the emissions intensity of specific products imported into the EU. But on the part that you mentioned, so yeah, CSRD is focused on European companies, but it also affects companies that have a certain percentage or amount of revenue within Europe.
Okay.
So even if you're based in the US or another kind of country, if you have operations in Europe, it's likely you're also going to be affected.
Wow, interesting. It'd be interesting to see how well we can affect that into into international countries, like you say, like the US, and how well that goes down. How would you say, where would you say Europe sits within that? I mean, just listening to you speak then, I'm kind of thinking, thank God there are these regulations, because whilst I'm not necessarily always a fan of bureaucracy and regulations for the sake of regulations, of which, you know, Europe is historically very good at creating, I think, when you hear about those kind of regulations, you think, thank God that they're actually there, because, you know, it's raising awareness, isn't it? Like you said, when people have to start reporting on this, that's having the trickle-down effect that you want, like say, upstream and downstream from a lot of the financial institutions and their suppliers and so on and so forth. So I think it's fantastic that this is coming, and I think it's great that you're sort of spotting these trends and you're ahead of the crest of the curve to make the most of it in terms of what you build. But where do Europe sit in relation to the rest of the world, do you think, on this sort of area? Are these regulations relatively pioneering in relation to, you said it's not happened before, but in relation to, I guess further west and further east, where do we sit on that?
Europe is definitely leading the pack here. I think they've taken a lot of very bold moves with the amount of regulation and exactly how it's structured on an incentive level.
Okay.
I mean, how the trickiest part comes from this whole scope three part, right? The reason that they've had to create this kind of incentive system, and Europe is, first of all, to answer your question, Europe is the leader, and a lot of countries, the UK is following very similar path towards the rest of kind of the EU. And the US is also kind of soon following in a lot of this. But I think most countries look towards Europe when it comes to this regulation, because they're the most advanced in this and also are taking kind of the most bold moves, which other countries I think are very much observing. But some phenomenal advances there. And the reason that this has to be the way that it has panned out is because of this whole scope three part, which is, If a company within Europe outsources its supply chain towards another continent or country, it's actually very hard to actually understand kind of your total emissions. And so you need to make sure that everyone is just constantly aligned on every side, that the investors and asset managers have regulatory and market pressure, that they downstream towards these companies, that these companies then become responsible and don't just say, hey, that's my supply chain, I don't have to understand it, but that there is ownership and accountability across not just your company, but who you decide to have as a supplier, and having the right it's a global problem just because of that scope three and supply chain part.
Yeah.
I think one thing that we see just looking into the carbon modeling part, and it's actually really interesting on a data science perspective and so much applications, because carbon modeling typically is very rule-based, but the outcomes obviously is data science. You can see obviously what are the averages, what are outliers, how can I use machine learning and data science to better understand and predict different things. So there's just such a good intersection of both. But one common mistake that happens when you look at the average, you Google the average emissions of a person in the UK, is they take the total emissions of the UK, they divide it by the amount of people. And the thing is, if the UK is outsourcing X percentage of their supply chain in the car industry to another country, they're just saying that they're not responsible for that. Mm. So one of the trends has been towards consumption-based emissions, looking at just tracking as a consumer globally, what emissions do I have and what's my dependency on other countries for what I buy? If I buy a car in the UK, but it comes from Germany, Italy, making sure we take into account the full scope and we don't just blame other countries and say, hey, it's their problem. But it's really our problem as consumers and our responsibility for if we buy something, responsible for the emissions of where that came from.
Yeah, absolutely. It is fascinating. And you know, I guess the UK, we are historically a pretty prolific importer of all goods, especially, you know, you look at like the Far East and in terms of China and how much of the products that we buy that comes from there really does sort of beg that question. It must be quite a very difficult thing to police though in those businesses, those countries where they have lesser regulation and, you know, lesser visibility on their data. Like for instance, China, let's say, you know, and I guess not casting aspersions here, but China are very often not particularly keen to share specific data that relates to their country. How do you police that if you're kind of a company and you've got a supply chain that comes from, say, China in particular, it's very difficult for you to get that data. How would you go about clarifying that whole situation?
Yeah, it's there's a variety of different ways. And I think the hard part many times is it's hard to have a real ground truth unless you're on the ground measuring the total gases released in every process and the dependencies. It's very hard to track. So what we've built together with some of the leading university research groups is there's different classifications of data when it comes to carbon modeling. And it makes it really interesting as a data science topic because you can't sometimes necessarily say one is better than the other. They're just different types and methodologies somewhat. Okay. And so I'm really interested in how the climate space and carbon modeling space can progress forwards together with a lot of the learnings within data science in the past kind of 5-10 years. I studied AI and software engineering in university, and the models that they have now with GPT and the large language ones are completely different to what we got told was the best deep learning models not so long ago. So seeing what the intersection, how they can kind of help each other best is super interesting. But what we work on a lot with carbon modeling scientists is something called EIO, which is called environmentally extended input-output models. What they do is they calculate proxies for the average emissions for spending in a specific product category or industry in more than in multiple countries and regions. So you can make it multi-region. At Connect Earth, what we do is we find the average proxy and carbon emissions estimates, which is spend-based, for buying a whole host of different transaction categories and industries in more than 49 countries and regions, mapping the multi-region part, which means if I buy a car in the UK, we're also taking into account its dependency on purchases in Germany, in Italy, just the global dependency and mapping the global average supply chains. Okay. So partly, and happy to jump into EIO anytime, but conscious this might be, I'm not sure if it's so interesting towards your audience, but the other part, so what that's really helpful with is, hey, if your supplier is not giving you data, or if they are giving you data, but you're not so sure of it, you can use some of these global proxies to actually estimate what is the average and benchmark and what should I be expecting from these average emissions. And if they don't give it to you, you can actually use these EIO method.
Yeah.
And it's one of the leading ways that companies globally and some of the largest companies in the world are using to report on their supply chain. So it comes down to benchmarking to see if it's accurate. And second of all, having a really clear data classification. If a company a supplier tells you this is my total emissions and that's it, it's not very trustworthy because you don't know what's in that whole kind of bag of worms. Mm. So having very clear classification, the Greenhouse Gas Protocol is a good example. They classify data really specifically and say you have to have reporting on this part, this part, this part, this part. So making sure that's complete. And I think where the data science aspect is really interesting is we have tons of outlier detection. So we have a whole pipeline that after capturing the carbon emissions data on companies, passing it through, we see, okay, how does this deviate from average and what's expected within that industry? How can we catch outliers early? Because it could be a misreporting problem. It could be that they're really green or they're not close to average. Or It could also be that there's a typo in a report, which is very, very common. You're always going to expect around a 1% to 3% kind of typo error within carbon emissions data and reports. And you have to have the data science tools to be able to filter, process, and classify a lot of this.
It's really, really interesting. And I genuinely find it fascinating. I could talk about it for hours, but I, like you said, we could probably go so far down a wormhole that we struggle to find our way back to where we are. But I genuinely find it very interesting. And I think that would make a lot of sense. Obviously, there are those kind of ways of assuming that data in a logical fashion, if logistically it's not forthcoming. But just listening to you speak, I can, you obviously make a great leader because you're really passionate about what you're talking about. And I think that's a hallmark of a strong leader is somebody that can really, kind of take somebody on that journey, and your passion for obviously what you do and obviously your expertise in what you do as well. It must be very infectious and get people to kind of come on that journey with you. So let's talk a little bit about your management style, your leadership style, I guess, and the Diary of a CTO is all about kind of how you lead, and how you get the best out of people. So talk us through when you've obviously built this team from scratch. You mentioned having this mission you think has been a real kind of USP to engage the best candidates, which I definitely can see from a lot of the conversations we have. But how do you go about scaling a team from scratch? Are there particular approaches, particular processes that you look for, I guess, in terms of how you structure the team, but also the people that you look for? And are there any sort of core attributes and characteristics that you might look for, within a team, irrespective of the role? So talk us through a little bit about how you've kind of built the team and scaled it to date.
Yeah, great question. I think it's something at this stage. So we're around 15 people at the moment. We're looking to pretty much go above 20, 25 employees in the next year, and have some we're very actively hiring at the moment, mainly for engineering roles and then kind of data science and carbon modeling roles. Some of these roles, being in a pioneering space, some of these roles a lot of times just didn't exist. So hiring our carbon modeling scientist, someone who's a specialist in Python and EEIO, was one of the hardest things because there's no guidance on it. A lot of times that job title kind of doesn't really exist a lot of times. And I spent 3-4 months contacting hundreds of people on LinkedIn in some of the academic courses. A lot of them were finishing their PhDs. A lot of them were looking to go into academia, just trying to source. And if they weren't available, contacting some of their colleagues within university to try and ask if they're available. So there's a really big, I think, now need for carbon modeling people in the intersection of environmental sciences and data science. Also, as a result, because sometimes that doesn't necessarily exist, you need two people. There's an environmental scientist and a data scientist. That's a lot of data scientists we've been seeing have a big passion for wanting to get into environment and have an impact. And I think when it comes to scaling our team, initially it was just me and Alex. It was a lot of grunt work. I think there's a certain escape velocity you have to hit as a startup where the founding team has to go very fast and scale the company to get you out of orbit. Pretty much, and make this into something. But after that, it's kind of almost an anti-pattern if the founders become the blockers. So it becomes really, really big on trust. You need to be able to hire people that can take initiative, that you can trust to take big decisions. You're a small company doing a lot of things, and you want to make sure things are done right. So I think trust is maybe one of the biggest things that we see as we scale our team. And I think there's two avenues typically, and we're clarifying this right now with our employees as well, is people can either become experts in their field. In Amazon, it was you become software engineer 1, 2, 3, or you become a manager. You go into technical product management, et cetera.
Yeah.
Just knowing very clearly with your employees what route they want to take on a regular basis can help you understand how you progress the company a lot better. But I think fundamentally, being in the climate space, I think we've had the luxury that being mission-driven has led a lot of really talented people to come to us. The difficult part a lot of times is also filtering through a lot of good candidates.
Yeah.
A lot of people are passionate, but we have to be very restrictive with who we hire. We have limited resources and hire very, very talented people, but they can execute in the short term and the long term can become either our senior experts or some of the leaders within the business.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree. And I think it's great that you sort of have those check-in points regularly with your people about which route do you want to go down. And like you said, just because you've picked one path doesn't mean you can't necessarily move to the other path because, obviously it's... I think Amazon, one of those pioneering companies that actually recognized that, and it was this way in recruitment as well, actually. You get to a certain level of performance as an individual consultant and then it was assumed the next step for you is to be a people manager and you start growing a team because you're good at the job. But it doesn't always stand true that because you're good at the job, you make a good manager. And I think, it's very much the same in technology. Very often of my 15 years of doing the job, I've had a lot of candidates that come to me and say, well, I feel like I've really hit the ceiling where I am because the next step for me, I'm very passionate, hands-on, IC, I want to stay technically at the coalface, but the next step for me is to move into a management role. I don't really want to do that because I enjoy coding. That's what I want to do. And the company loses a great asset because they don't have those channels open to them. And I think just checking in with people regularly, are you on the right path? Do you feel you're on the right trajectory? I think that's one of the most important things in any company can do to retain talent. Absolutely. I totally agree with that. But would you say, is there a sort of core thread of characteristics and attributes that you look for, would be that sort of competence-based or even attitude-based? You mentioned trust, make big decisions. I think that's absolutely massive and that kind of really resonates with me. Obviously, we're a relatively early stage business as well. And, very much like you said, the first few years of me starting this business is, pedaling as quickly as we can to get the business up and off the ground. And then obviously, so we were able to scale and grow and get the right people on board. And I very much believe that the kind of people that we bring into the team now, they're the people that I want to see here in 10 years time and, get those people that I feel really have those abilities to step into those bigger roles. How do you approach that? Are there particular metrics or characteristics or attributes that you look at for all of your employees?
Yeah, sure thing. I think it comes down, if we look at it on a global level, it comes down to trust. Could you trust this person to be the leader of tomorrow when given a very big banking client, for example, to be able to answer difficult questions and execute exactly on what the client needs are and develop the product in a way that benefits us in the short term and long term? Trust, I think, is the fundamental one, and I think it can be broken down into several different things. The first one is initiative. So we're a small company. Our business goes at the pace that we can take decisions without the founders being involved. So at what pace can you, how quickly can you take decisions without any single individual becoming a blocker? And I think part of this goes to, in Agile and Scrum practices, there's a concept of a self-organizing team. Is your team self-organizing? And the way that you can ensure that is if your developers, your data scientists, your commercial people, your marketing people really fundamentally care about your mission and are willing to take initiative to, if not told, take action towards what's the best for the company and propose things that would really fundamentally benefit. So I think initiative and self-organizing is a really important part. Obviously, then the passion piece is huge, not only for, I think, climate tech, but also the individual domain that they're entering. You have to be passionate about both climate and data science if you're really going into it. One thing that maybe sometimes is hard is being a very mission-driven company. Everyone is really mission-driven, but if you're only in it for, I guess, the mission-driven part and maybe not excelling in some of the other parts, it could be that you're kind of sometimes stunting the potential growth because fundamentally, it's all connected. We need the data science part to be as accurate as possible and as good as possible. The engineering side to be constantly improving. You have to be both really passionate about environment and also your specific expertise. And then one last one, I think, comes down to care. Do you do work that you're proud of? And in the book Clean Code, which is one of the really popular ones in software engineering, Robert C. Martin talks about clean code, meaning does it look like someone that cares wrote it? Does the code look like someone cared? And I think that's fundamentally something that we can all kind of understand when we see something. When a task is done with care and you see someone really put their best effort and really wants it to go well. So I think these are quite high level things, but it requires both domain expertise, but also a set of personality qualities that just show that, yeah, you're trustworthy, you care, you want the best for the company, for the team, for yourself, and everyone to grow.
Yeah, I love that. I think the care piece is, you know, people can't always make the right decisions. Everybody makes mistakes, you know, irrespective of, you know, how bought into the business people are. But if people genuinely care and you know they're making the right decisions for the right reasons, you know, that's one of the most important things, isn't it, really? Like I say, it's that, it boils back down to trust, I guess, again, that, you know, if you trust in people that they're doing the best job they can. Somebody said to me the other day, I can't remember who the quote was from, but, you know, one of the CTOs I spoke to said, whenever I'm speaking to anybody in my team, I always have it in the back of my mind that, you know, no one comes to work to do a bad job intentionally. You know, they're kind of there for the right reasons. And if they're not, then they're not the right people to have on the boat, you know, the right people to have in the team. And yeah, I think they're some really strong traits and characteristics that I definitely resonate with.
Facebook have and I think that's totally makes so much sense, and I think allowing failure is so important.
Yeah.
And almost programming and organizing your team in such a way that they can fail a lot really faster. The common Facebook phrase is move fast and break things.
Yeah.
And it sounds like you're being very clumsy, but no, you're just creating some artificial walls internally so that you can crash internally and your clients would never be affected. I think on a geeky side, like having a really good CI/CD, a continuous integration and continuous deployment pipeline is so important to make sure that no matter what code that you deploy, you have these kind of like it's bulletproof, and you have these walls where you can test crash into things before any clients can see it. And just being able to fail fast by having these artificial walls is so important.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's the practical element of failure, isn't there? Insofar as, like you say, especially when it's a technology system, making sure it's not going to have catastrophic implications. But there's also then the cultural piece around failure and how that's perceived within the business. And I think the companies that get that right are the ones that like you say, they kind of see failure in a really positive light and they reframe it for people that it's not necessarily a bad thing. I always think back to a client that we worked with quite a bit, albeit a number of years ago now, Just Giving, you know, the kind of digital kind of charity platform. And I always remember when I went to their offices there, they spoke about how they have this thing on a Monday morning called the Church of Fail, where everybody has to get up on a Monday morning and basically say something that they did wrong the week before. The whole premise is you're turning failure into something that's celebrated and reframed in a positive light, because everybody then can learn from that rather than, you know, sweep it under the carpet and it happened. It's actually a knowledge transfer around what went wrong, how can we address that next time.
Very cool.
And it was quite cool because they told me, it's quite funny because depending on the severity of the thing and how bad it was that they did, the only thing that they did at the end, when they said what they did wrong, they everyone clapped. And then if it was a really bad thing, they couldn't sit down until everyone had finished clapping. So if it was a really bad thing, they would keep them up there for ages just clapping, and then eventually they could sit down. But it was made me laugh. It was
very
funny.
Cool.
So yeah, but Nick, look, I've really, really enjoyed the chat. I think it's been fascinating episode, and super passionate about what you're doing, and I find it very interesting indeed. And I think it's such a worthwhile mission, and you know, I kind of thank God that there's people out there like you that really take it upon themselves to apply their skills and expertise to solve these bigger problems, because quite frankly, if there weren't people like you, then you know, we'd all be in trouble. So it's great that you're using your skills in a way that impacts and benefits us all. So thank you very much for that, and thank you again for coming on the episode and being a part of it. And I for one will definitely be keeping my eyes very close to Connect Earth and seeing how you guys continue to grow and evolve, and keeping track of your progress as time goes on. And I wish you all the very best for the future.
Thanks a lot. Really appreciate it.
Cool. Take care.
Thank you.